injustice. We are bound to be swayed away. We are bound to be very much disturbed. But yoga says that if you experience yoga, that means in the midst of storms and stresses and strain, you know the secret of keeping calm. That is the first definition. The second definition is, yoga is skill in action. It's not running away from life, but whatever we do it efficiently, skillfully, as perfectly as possible. The third definition is that yoga is to know the right proportion of everything. Whatever we do in our life, we have to do different things, pursue different activities. Whatever you do it in right proportion. I'm only giving you the main idea. Perhaps during the talk, Mr. Mehta will elaborate all these ideas and something more also. So when these definitions of yoga are given, and when the whole philosophy is unveiled before the disciple Arjuna, he says that what is the use of all this high philosophy? Because even though I intellectually understand, somehow my mind is restless. I can't concentrate. It is just like trying to hold the wind, but I cannot hold the wind. My mind is restless. Then the Lord, Shri Krishna, gives him the instruction as to how he can quieten the mind. I shall not talk anything about it, but because I am sure during the talk that subject will be touched upon. But the Lord, the teacher says that in your life there has to be a twofold process, active and yet be like a witness. Even though you are acting, you are watching yourself, you are observing yourself. That is the instruction that is given in the verse, one of the verses which I shall sing. Then the disciple says that, my doubts are dissolved, I shall do thy bidding. Whatever you ask me to do, I will do, because now my doubts are dissolved, I have understood what you want to convey. This is a very general meaning of the verses that I shall sing. This will be followed by a song, because in the whole of Bhagavad Gita, the teacher asks Arjuna to be an instrument, that you don't fight, but you become only an instrument. And the song which I shall sing is about being an instrument. The poet, the mystic poet, gives a simile of flute, that I am only a flute, a musical instrument. I don't play, I don't sing, but there is a divine musician, there is a divine singer who plays the note, who sings, and therefore I am only an instrument. Once again, a very central idea of the Bhagavad Gita, be an instrument.
Yogastha Kuru Karmai Murali अनंत विवेक बजाओ यत्र योगेश्वर कृष्ण यत्र योगेश्वर कृष्ण यत्र पार्थो तत्र श्रीर्विजयो भूति ध्रुवानीति मतिर्मम निमित्तमात्रं भासव्यसाचि
Friends, I must say at the outset that there will be no break. Even if there is a break, there will be no second session after the break. There is one reason for this, because during the days that are before us, the 3 days during which we are going to meet, I will have to revert to Bhagavad Gita again and again. And therefore, many questions that may arise in your minds today probably can get solved in the subsequent talks so far as the Bhagavad Gita is concerned. And therefore, we will not have the continuing session after the break. We will meet tomorrow. And as I said, now we have come to the central point of our main subject of discussion, in which Bhagavad Gita can be of very great help, and that is why we will revert to it again and again. Bhagavad Gita is an amazing book. It is not the scripture of the Hindus. In fact, in Hinduism there is no scripture at all. In fact, one does not know who founded Hinduism. We do not know who the founder of Hinduism is. And therefore, there is nothing of sectarianism so far as the Bhagavad Gita is concerned. It is a universal book, a book to which you can turn, whatever may be your faith, whatever may be the subject of your belief, you can turn to the Bhagavad Gita and you are bound to find some answer to the perplexing questions of life. On the Bhagavad Gita, many commentaries have written. In fact, Bhagavad Gita is a book which has been translated in all the languages of the world. And there are many, many commentaries. And still more commentaries are being written. In fact, there is no end to the writing of commentaries so far as the Bhagavad Gita is concerned, because it is a book of immense value to people who belong to any religion or to no religion. You will not find such universality of appeal as you find in the Bhagavad Gita. And it is this Bhagavad Gita which we are going to take up for our study in relationship to the consciousness which has been the main subject of our discussion. This consciousness is discussed in the Bhagavad Gita. And it has been discussed in the Bhagavad Gita in such a universal manner that one does not have to stretch one's thinking in order to understand what the Bhagavad Gita wishes to teach. The Bhagavad Gita, as you know, is a dialogue. As all scriptural texts of Hindus, not scriptures, but all scriptural texts of Hindus, and there are many, many. There is not just one. There are many, many scriptural texts of the Hindus. You will find that all those texts, they have followed one principle, and that is the principle of dialogue. In the scriptural text after scriptural text, you will find this dialogue followed, whether it is in the Bhagavad Gita, or it is in the Upanishads, or it is in various other texts. You will find that there is no teacher who lays down the law. No teacher says, this is what you must do. It is only the method of dialogue between the teacher and the pupil. It is this which is the basis of all these scriptural texts. And therefore the Bhagavad Gita also follows the same method of dialogue. And it is a dialogue between the teacher, who is Sri Krishna, and the pupil, who is Arjuna. It is a dialogue between these two. Arjuna puts question after question, and the Lord gives answers. In fact, such is the stimulating dialogue that whenever questions do not come easily in the mouth of Arjuna, Sri Krishna persuades Arjuna to put questions, as it were frames questions. Why don't you ask this question? Why don't you ask this question? And therefore, it is this method of dialogue which is very, very prominent so far as all scriptural texts are concerned, but particularly with reference to the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita outwardly is in the background of a war, the great war that seems to have taken place. Whether it is a real war or it is a mythological war, nobody can say. But war is the theme round about which this whole message of the Bhagavad Gita has been woven. It is a war, and in this war there are two important personages. One is Sri Krishna and the other is Arjuna. Arjuna puts questions after questions. In fact, the Bhagavad Gita begins with the despondency of Arjuna. Remember, the Bhagavad Gita has to be understood not merely verbally, not just read and understood in the terms in which the Bhagavad Gita has been written. Bhagavad Gita is a symbolical book. And therefore, unless and until we understand the symbolism of the Bhagavad Gita, it will be very, very difficult for us to follow intelligently the line of thought that is developed in this book. As I said, the background is that of war, the great war, the Mahabharata, war of Mahabharata. Because the Bhagavad Gita is to be found in the middle of the Mahabharata. It's a part of Mahabharata. And it is a part of Mahabharata because it deals with the subject matter of war. There is this atmosphere of war very vividly described in the first discourse of the Bhagavad Gita. And in the first discourse of the Bhagavad Gita, we find Arjuna in a state of despondency, a state of dejection, a state of despair. This is once again symbolical. Unless and until I have a discontent, unless and until I also suffer, just as Arjuna suffered, from a sense of despondency, unless this despondency arises, discontent arises, discontent with regard to the way in which I carry on my living, discontent with regard to what happens round about me, unless and until there is the awakening of that discontent, it is not possible for us to understand intelligently the whole message of the Bhagavad Gita. In fact, the man of spirituality, and the Bhagavad Gita shows the path of spirituality, the man of spirituality can start on the path of spiritual perspectives only by taking the first step, and the first step is the step of discontent, of despondency, of thoroughly discontented with the way in which one is leading one's life or the way in which the world is moving. It is this discontent which is the background. And Arjuna is so despondent that he throws away the arms. He says, Lord, I don't want to fight. I'm not want to fight. He was so in such a condition of despondency that he threw away the arms. He belonged to the warrior class, the Kshatriya class, and it does not behove a Kshatriya to throw away the arms. But you will find in the very first discourse, Arjuna throwing away the arms because of the despondency that had overtaken him. It is from that point that the Bhagavad Gita starts. Because Arjuna wants to run away from the battlefield. And Arjuna was not a coward. He had fought many battles. He had fought many, many battles successfully. He was not a coward. He was not afraid of going into war. But there was a cause of despondency which gradually develops in the Bhagavad Gita. But as I said, he wanted to run away from the battlefield. And the meaning of the Bhagavad Gita becomes valid to us, becomes relevant to us when we understand when Sri Krishna tells Arjuna that you cannot run away. You will have to face the battle. You cannot run away. Not only that, he says, I have closed all the ways of running away, all the ways of escape. Where are you going to go? There is no escape that is open to you. You have to face the battle. And therefore, nobody can say that the Bhagavad Gita teaches an individual renunciation, renunciation of the world, renunciation of the world of activity. On the contrary, the Bhagavad Gita says, you will have to be on the field, which is the field of activity. You cannot run away. You cannot think of running away. You must face the battle of life. Face the battle of life. But at one place, Sri Krishna tells Arjuna that I want to fight this battle, but I want you to fight the battle not as other people fight, but to fight in a different manner. We will see what that different manner is. But the fact of the matter is that it applies to all of us, because sometime or the other, we become despondent. We are taken by depression, we are despaired of what is taking place. And we want to run away from the battle of life, to take shelter somewhere else, to go to an ashrama, to go to a guru, or to go to any other place so that I may not have to face the battle of life. We, all of us, are in the midst of the battle of life. And the battle is not easy, it's very, very difficult. But we cannot run away from the battle, because where shall we run away? This is the battle of life. We cannot run away from life itself. This is really the central theme so far as the Bhagavad Gita is concerned. In other words, Bhagavad Gita says, you will have to fight. You cannot run away. You cannot take shelter in anything. You will have to fight and fight, but fight in a different manner. We will go into this question later on, what this different manner was suggested by Sri Krishna. The Bhagavad Gita, one wonders, what is it? Is it the book of philosophy? Yes. Is it the book of yoga? Yes, it is the book of yoga. Is it the book of action? Yes, it is the book of action. Is it the book of psychology? It is the book of psychology. All put together, it's very difficult to define whether it is a philosophical book or it is a book which deals with day-to-day psychological problems of the human individual. It is all rolled in one. And that is why one can say that it is difficult to find another book like the Bhagavad Gita, so complete, so Catholic, so free from all tinge of sectarianism, completely secular, secular if you want to use that word. Such is this book, and this is the book that we are going to take up because it discusses the question of consciousness. It discusses the question of consciousness in a holistic manner, not a fragmented manner. Our consciousness is fragmented. Consciousness is the window through which we look at life. That is what we have defined, because consciousness is life in manifestation. When life manifests itself, then it can be understood, it can be seen, it can be perceived only through the window of consciousness. And therefore, if we go to Bhagavad Gita, we find that there is this consciousness that is depicted in various aspects. It is the growth of consciousness which forms part of the discussion of the Bhagavad Gita. It is certainly a book of philosophy, it is a book of religion, but one might say that it is not a book of morality. The Bhagavad Gita is not a book of morality, in the sense that the Bhagavad Gita does not say anywhere, do this, do not do that. There are no do's and don'ts so far as the Bhagavad Gita is concerned. In fact, the Bhagavad Gita deals with the whole subject in a psychological manner. Psychological manner. As I said the other day, the psychological approach is, why do you do this? Or why do you not do this? Go into the causes as to why you do something and the causes as to why you do not do something. It is this that is discussed so far as the Bhagavad Gita is concerned, and therefore it has nothing to do with moral injunctions. Sri Aurobindo, one of the most eminent thinkers of our age, he says in his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, and he has written a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita entitled Essays on the Gita. That is the title of the book. In that book, Sri Aurobindo says that the Bhagavad Gita is not a book of morality. It is a book of spirituality. And spirituality is not an extension of morality. In fact, it is something which functions at a different dimension. There is the moral dimension of do and do not do this, of the do's and the don'ts. These are the moral injunctions. But throughout the Bhagavad Gita, and the Bhagavad Gita has 700 verses divided in 18 chapters, in all these 700 verses, not even at one place you will find that Sri Krishna has asked Arjuna, do this or do not do this. In fact, he goes on explaining, and Arjuna puts question after question, and Sri Krishna is not tired of dealing with these questions. In fact, as I said earlier, he induces the disciple to ask more questions and still more questions. But one might say that if one has to describe what the Bhagavad Gita is, what is the nature of the Bhagavad Gita, one can say without any fear of contradiction that the Bhagavad Gita is a book of yoga. And yoga is psychology. In fact, yoga psychology is the greatest contribution of Hinduism to the world, yoga psychology. The Bhagavad Gita preeminently is a book of yoga. But what is this yoga? Has any indication been given as to what is the nature of this yoga about which the Bhagavad Gita speaks? Yes, there is an indication given by Sri Krishna himself. Sri Krishna tells Arjuna, I am teaching you yoga. But what is this yoga? Buddhi yogam dadamyaham. I am giving you a yoga, not the yoga of intellect, but the yoga of intelligence. The yoga of intuition. We these days use the word intelligence in place of intuition. The Bhagavad Gita stands for this yoga of intelligence. And while speaking about this intelligence, Sri Krishna says at one place in one of the shlokas, one of the verses of the Bhagavad Gita, and he says that great are the senses, but greater than the senses is the mind, and greater than the mind is the intelligence, and greater than intelligence is the soul or the spirit. This is how it is discussed. In other words, he says the senses are great. Of course the senses are great, because senses have great fields to cover, and senses are able to move in larger and larger field as the senses are developed by certain processes into which we shall go tomorrow, because tomorrow we are going to consider this question of the sensorial and extrasensorial experience. But nevertheless, the senses are great. The field of the senses can be extended. But Sri Krishna says, greater than the senses is the mind. The mind is much greater. The mind directs the senses. The senses do certain things at the behest of the mind. And therefore, mind is greater than the senses. But he goes on saying that intelligence, buddhi, buddhi is the word that is used in Sanskrit, buddhi or intelligence is greater than the mind. Mind is not the final verdict. There is something beyond the mind, greater than the mind. And it is this greater than the mind which is buddhi. And Sri Krishna says, it is this yoga of buddhi, the yoga of intelligence which I am teaching you. We will go further into the question later on, tomorrow, day after, when time permits. We will go into this question of the yoga of buddhi, the yoga of intelligence. But this is the basic fact which needs to be noted. Bhagavad Gita is a book of yoga. Yoga is the Hindu psychology. And in that Hindu psychology, Bhagavad Gita teaches the yoga of intelligence, not the yoga of intellect. It doesn't mean that the intellect has to be brushed aside. Intellect is useful, just as the senses are useful. We do not ask the senses to shut up. We want the senses to bring more and more, greater and greater report of the outer world. Just as the senses are needed, they are important. Similarly, the mind is important. Mind has not to be brushed aside. Mind has its place. And we shall see, as the Bhagavad Gita tells us, how the mind has its place. But mind has its place, a limited place. Beyond that limit, when we go, then we come to buddhi or intelligence. This is what is discussed so far as the Bhagavad Gita is concerned. The mind must know its capacities. Mind must know its capacities. But the mind must also know its limitations. The mind that knows its capacities and the mind that is aware of its limitations is an intelligent mind. As J. Krishnamurti used to say very often, the mind that says, I do not know, is the most intelligent mind. The mind says that says, I do not know, because generally the mind says, I know everything, I know everything, I know everything. But the mind that knows its own limitations, that is an intelligent mind, but knows its limitations after having explored its capacity. And therefore, it is not a dull mind, not an indolent mind, not a lazy mind, but the mind is tremendously active. And yet that active mind knows that he can go thus far and no further. It has not to be controlled from outside. The mind controls itself, the intelligent mind controls itself, it disciplines itself, and he says, I cannot go into this field because this field is something which is not valid to me. I have no validity so far as that field is concerned. To know that, to know how far the mind can go, where the mind can function, where the mind can function intelligently, but also to know where the mind cannot go. The mind that understands this, the mind does not require any outer instruction. The intelligent mind understands this, that here is a question which is outside measurement, outside quantity. Outside quantity, outside measurement, I cannot go. In fact, at one place in the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna tells Arjuna that I reside in the heart of everyone. Everyone, whether he is a sinner or is a saint, I reside in the heart of everyone. But you do not find me because of your measuring activities. You want to measure everything. It is this mind, the mind which measures. I want to measure love. I want to measure truth. I want to measure God. And if something comes within that measurement, then I accept. Something which does not come in this measurement, I do not accept. And Sri Krishna tells Arjuna that even though I reside in the hearts of everyone, I am everywhere, I am omnipresent. There is no place where I am not, but you are not able to find, you are not able to perceive me, although I am there, you are not able to perceive me because of your activity of measurement. In other words, the mind cannot see. There are things which mind cannot see, because mind judges all the time by measurement. The mind has a measuring tape, and by that measuring tape it judges. The mind wants to measure everything, to calculate everything, to reason out everything. In other words, the mind which has two very powerful instruments, one is logic and the other is mathematics. We want everything to be contained in logic and mathematics. And because we demand this, we miss many, many things, because logic cannot give answer to everything. There is something which is more than logic, which is not illogical, but which is beyond logic. There are things which cannot be mathematically proved, because there is something which is beyond mathematics. And therefore, it is this measuring activity of the mind which goes only by measurement, it is this which does not help you to see me, although I am everywhere. This me and mine, which appears in the Bhagavad Gita constant, in chapter after chapter you will find, me and mine. And one wonders, what is this me? Come unto me. Does it mean that come unto the person of Sri Krishna? How can we go to the person of Sri Krishna? We don't see him at all. Sri Krishna is not here. How can we go? Then what is the meaning of me and mine? This question does arise, and to this question, Sri Krishna himself has given an answer. He says, I am the unmanifest. Not only he says this, but I the unmanifest, it is the person who is deluded who worship me as the manifest. I am the unmanifest, and therefore the me and the mine in the Bhagavad Gita, and you find this coming up again and again, me and mine represent the unmanifest. Unmanifest. Not that which is manifest, but the unmanifest. And we have seen, as we were discussing, this unmanifest is something which cannot be discovered by the measurements of the mind. It transcends the measurements of the mind. And therefore, it has to be found, it has to be discovered, not by the usual processes to which we are committed, the processes of the mind, but some other process. In other words, this buddhi, this intelligence, is much greater than the mind. And it is only when this intelligence is born, or intuition, call it by whatever name you like, it is when the intelligence is born, then it is that intelligence which will give us the understanding of that which cannot come in any measurement so far as the mind is concerned. The Bhagavad Gita, as I said, is a system, gives us a system of integral philosophy. Its yoga is also an integral yoga. It discusses the philosophy, the philosophical aspect. It discusses what is known as the path of knowledge, jnana. It is the path of knowledge. Bhagavad Gita gives us the path of knowledge, and very clear. The path of knowledge is depicted before Arjuna. It talks of the path of knowledge. It talks of path of action. In fact, it goes into the question of what action is. the whole structure of the Bhagavad Gita is so beautifully constructed that the first six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, first six in the Bhagavad Gita, there are 18 chapters. The first six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, they deal with the problem of knowledge. It is the problem of knowledge that is discussed. The last six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita, they deal with action, with the philosophy of action. What is action? What is reaction? What is inaction? It is this whole subject of action that is discussed in the last six discourses of the Bhagavad Gita. In the middle six chapters, they deal with the path of devotion. Because it is only when there is the path of devotion known to the individual that he will be able to translate his knowledge into action. Our fundamental problem is we know so much, but unfortunately we are not able to translate it into action. In fact, in all religions this statement has been made, and the statement is, I know what is right, but I cannot pursue the path of right. I know what is wrong, but I cannot refrain from it. This is our difficulty. I know intellectually, I understand by means of knowledge what is right, but I am unable to pursue it. I know intellectually what is wrong, and yet I am unable to refrain from it. This is the difficulty with which we are faced all the time. Intellectually we know what should be done, what is right, but we are unable to follow that path of right. Intellectually we know what should be avoided, what is not right, but we are unable to avoid it. This is the difficulty of all of us, and it is this difficulty that needs to be understood. It is in the background of the Bhagavad Gita that it is possible for us to understand this difficulty. Why does it arise? The Bhagavad Gita says, yes, you have knowledge. You know what action is, but you have no connecting link between knowledge and action. And the connecting link is to be found in devotion. Modern man has become a stranger to devotion. We seem to be thinking that devotion is mere emotionalism, that devotion is just effusion, emotionalism. But it is not. Devotion is something very, very clear. And without this devotion, without this bracket of devotion, without this factor of devotion, it is not possible, it will never be possible for us to translate knowledge into action. And the Bhagavad Gita, therefore, deals with knowledge, deals with devotion, deals with action. And therefore, one can say, it gives us a complete philosophy of life. There is nothing that is left out. And yet, there are many, many things which a person has to work out. The Bhagavad Gita is not just a book where everything is stated explicitly. There is much that is suggestive. And unless and until you pick up those suggestive aspects, you will not be able to find a creative joy so far as the following of the Bhagavad Gita is concerned. Bhagavad Gita does not lay down as to what should be done under various circumstances. It does not say what should not be done in the various circumstances. It gives a hint. It gives a suggestive hint. If we can understand the suggestive hint, then we can work out. Each individual has to work out the problem. Here the suggestive hints are given. In many, many verses, these suggestive hints are given. And it is these suggestive hints that enable us. And that is the creative part. It enables us to carve out our own path in the midst of the difficulties of life. In fact, many people have found that the Bhagavad Gita seems to give us hint about all the difficult situations of life. Mahatma Gandhi was the great leader of India. He used to say that whenever I'm in difficulty, I open the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavad Gita gives me a clear hint in the midst of the difficult situations in which I am. This is the experience of many, many people. Not because it explicitly says 1, 2, 3, 4, That is not the method of the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita throws suggestions. There is a suggestivity so far as the discussion in the Bhagavad Gita is concerned. And if we can understand these suggestions, then we can move along that path, carve out our own path, be creative so far as that path is concerned, so that even though it shows the way, it does not take away the creative urge of the human individual. That is the beauty so far as the Bhagavad Gita is concerned. Now, having given this general introduction so far as the Bhagavad Gita is concerned, let us see what are the specific things about which the Bhagavad Gita speaks. Arjuna, as I said in the first discourse, was in a state of despondency. He was not afraid of death, but he did not want to see so many people dying in war. Venerable people, respected people, his teachers, his friends, he did not want to see these people destroyed. And therefore the despondency has arisen. Not because he was afraid of war, not because he was afraid of death, but he did not want to see the spectacle of so many dear ones, so many respected people. And therefore the despondency has arisen. Not because he was afraid of war, not because he was afraid of death, but he did not want to see the spectacle of so many dear ones, so many respected people, so many of the friends dying. Because in a war, death is bound to take place. And he did not want to face the death of his comrades, the death of his friends. Dismayed Arjuna. And that is the root cause of despondency. And therefore you will find the Bhagavad Gita in the second discourse. The teacher does not open his mouth. The teacher says, well and good, if you have decided not to fight, what can I say? But in the beginning of the second discourse we find, Arjuna says that, Lord, I am your disciple, please teach me. He realizes that probably his decision not to fight may not be the correct decision. He is not able to come to the correct decision, but he says to the teacher, Lord, teach me, I am your pupil. Shishyasteham shadimam tvambhavam. I am your pupil. And therefore, in the second discourse, Arjuna goes to the teacher as a pupil. So long as he had not become a pupil, there was no teaching that was possible. Remember, in this whole business of teaching, one must understand that one can teach if the other person is teachable. That is the meaning of shishya. Shishya means, I have come to learn. Unless and until the awakening of learning takes place, the desire to learn, the desire to inquire, unless this takes place, it is not possible to give any teaching usefully and profitably. In fact, those of you who are members of the Theosophical Society will remember, in the Theosophical Society, there are three objects. But the third object stands for what does it stand? To inquire into the unexplained laws of nature. Having dealt with religion, philosophy, science, if there is something which still remains unexplained, then to investigate that unexplained. There are many, many things which are bound to remain unexplained. I must find out what are my areas of explanation, what are my areas where explanation does not seem to stand at all. As the scientist Einstein used to say, that the more we know, the more is the area that we do not know. The more we know, we have acquired knowledge, but the more knowledge we acquire, we become aware that there is still more to be known, still more to be known. And the area which is unknown seems to become larger and larger after every attempt at knowledge. This is the experience, this must be the experience of every spiritual aspirant. The flame of inquiry must never be extinguished. The flame of inquiry, when it is extinguished, then the person is, for all practical purposes, dead. He cannot learn because there is no end to learning. There is no end to acquiring knowledge. But this is something which can happen only when the flame of inquiry is ablaze. And therefore, the flame of inquiry must remain ablaze, so that I am a pupil. You and I must always remain pupils, pupils of life. Not that I know, because he says that he knows really does not know anything. He who says, I do not know, is a wise man, because he says, yes, there are many, many things into which I have to go, to inquire, to investigate. And the more I know, the more is the area of investigation. If that is our experience, and that is why in the Bhagavad Gita, the whole message of the Bhagavad Gita begins only when Arjuna says, I am your pupil, I really do not know. Teach me, because I am your pupil. When Arjuna says this, the disciple says this, then begins the positive message so far as the Bhagavad Gita is concerned. We must understand this background, because this background is very, very useful to understand the efficacy of the message of the Bhagavad Gita. Then Sri Krishna begins telling about death, because Bhagavad Gita tells us what death is, what is the meaning of death. But the Bhagavad Gita also tells us the meaning of life. But the meaning of life cannot be understood unless we understand, first of all, the meaning of death. Death not in the physical sense. He who dies, constantly dies, he alone can live. We cannot understand life unless there is constant dying. Dying not in the sense of the physical body being discarded, but dying means dying to all those things which we have collected, which we have gathered, which we have accumulated. To die to all those things, then only I am fresh, I am innocent, I am childlike, and therefore it will be possible for me to learn further. And therefore, we find in the second discourse a beautiful discussion on the problem of death. You will hardly find such an illuminating discussion on the problem of death as it is given in the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita, in other words, leads us to the perception of things which we ordinarily do not perceive. I said, perhaps yesterday or day before yesterday, that in the Bhagavad Gita there are two discourses, very important. The discourses are 10th and 11th discourse. In the 11th discourse, you find the Sri Krishna talking of something that belongs to the world of parapsychology, extrasensory perception. The whole of the extrasensory perception, it is this which is discussed in the 11th discourse. What you cannot see by your eyes. That is why he says, I will give you psychic perception. I will give you extrasensory perception. Then only you will be able to see my universal form. Otherwise you can't, because by these eyes you will not be able to see. This is the subject matter so far as the 11th discourse is concerned. It is the discourse which deals with the universal form. The disciple says to the teacher, please show me your universal form. The universal form is a form which extends to physical and non-physical realms. And therefore, please show me what you are, what is your form, what is your universal form. And then Sri Krishna says, you can't see with these eyes. You will have to have the extrasensory perception. You will have to have something that is discussed today in parapsychology. Unless and until you have that, it is not possible for you to see. And therefore, it deals with that. Whereas the 10th discourse, the earlier discourse, discusses something which does not require extrasensory perception, which is something not invisible at all, because the invisible requires the development of extrasensory perception. That which is not seen visibly, that which lies in the invisible realms, the invisible realms can be cognized only when we have that power, the power of extrasensory perception. But in the 10th discourse, Sri Krishna says, my glories, my splendors are everywhere. If you can look at the tree, if you can look at the dry leaf which has fallen, then behind that dry leaf I am there. I am everywhere. I am everywhere. You do not require extrasensory perception. By these very eyes you can see, if you know how to see. If your perception becomes sensitive, then with that sensitive perception, you will be able to cognize that which otherwise remains intangible. The tangible you can deal with by means of the senses, by means of the mind. But that which is beyond the tangibility, that which does not belong to the world of tangibility, that which is intangible, that intangible also can be known. And in the whole of the 10th discourse, in verse after verse, you will see how Sri Krishna deals with this intangible aspect. Intangible aspect. It's a beautiful discourse. The intangible aspect, everywhere. Go wherever you like. But you are bound to come across something which cannot be explained by mere tangibility. Something remains unexplained. And that something which remains unexplained is the intangible. And therefore, while the 11th discourse deals with the invisible, the 10th discourse deals with intangible. Such is the completeness of the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita, that it has dealt with the visible, it has dealt with the invisible, it has dealt with the intangible, and thus has given a complete picture so far as life is concerned. I can go on speak. I am only giving an introductory talk on the Bhagavad Gita, because as I said, we will have to revert to Bhagavad Gita, certain aspects of Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita is a holistic book, a book which discusses life from a holistic standpoint, wholeness, not the totality. And therefore, for example, you will find one definition of yoga that is given there in the Bhagavad Gita. The yoga of the Bhagavad Gita is the yoga of integration. Integration. Our consciousness is fragmented. To integrate it, that is the purpose of the yoga of the Bhagavad Gita. And the Bhagavad Gita gives us definition of yoga in terms of knowledge. And in terms of knowledge, it says, samatvam yoga uchyate. Samatvam means where the mind is in a state of equilibrium. This samatvam yoga uchyate is the definition of yoga along the lines of knowledge, along the lines of jnana marga, the path of knowledge. Along the path of knowledge, the definition of yoga is a state of equilibrium. No reactions. A mind that is completely free from reaction. A mind that does not react, but the mind that acts. This is the samatva about which the Bhagavad Gita speaks. The Bhagavad Gita gives another definition of yoga, which is the definition in terms of the path of action. Yoga karmasu kaushalam. He says, skill in action. Whatever you do, whether it is the sweeping of the floor, or it is the cooking of the food, or it is giving a lecture, or it is writing, whatever you may do, there must be a skill. It must be done with perfect excellence. This perfect excellence is the path of action about which the Bhagavad Gita speaks. But the Bhagavad Gita also speaks of yoga in terms of devotion, not merely in terms of knowledge, not merely in terms of action, but in terms of devotion, where Sri Krishna says that give up everything and come to me. What is that? Sarva dharman parityajya, mamekam saranam raja, aham tvam sarva papebhyo, moksha ishyami masucha. I shall release you from every bondage, but come to me. In other words, here it is the yoga of surrender, the yoga of action, the yoga of knowledge, and the yoga of surrender. In fact, the yoga of surrender is the most beautiful description of yoga that you find in the Bhagavad Gita. Thus, it gives us the understanding of the integral yoga. In other words, this is the development of consciousness that you find in the Bhagavad Gita. Consciousness that functions in the realm of knowledge, the consciousness that functions in the realm of actions, the consciousness that functions in the realm of devotion. It is this all-pervasive scheme of yoga about which the Bhagavad Gita speaks, and that is why it is fundamentally a book of integration, not a book of synthesis. There is a difference between synthesis and integration. In synthesis, only things are brought together. Things are put in juxtaposition. One after the other, the things are put. And you say, you have created a synthesis. But here in integration, there are no parts at all. All parts have merged into one. And because the parts have merged into one, it is the yoga of integration, not merely a yoga of synthesis. Very often people seem to mistake that the Bhagavad Gita gives us the yoga of synthesis. No, the Bhagavad Gita gives us the path of integration, so that the parts, they merge, they become the whole. They are inseparable. They are a part of one thing. It is this that is indicated so far as yoga of integration is. And the Bhagavad Gita's yoga is essentially the yoga of integration. In the Bhagavad Gita, there is the problem of the mind that is discussed again and again. In fact, the problem of the mind is discussed exhaustively. Because the Bhagavad Gita is concerned about teaching Arjuna that mind is not everything, that there must be the realms beyond the mind which must be explored. And therefore, going beyond the mind, how to still the mind, how to experience the quiet of the mind. Because in the quiet of the mind alone, there takes place the transcendence of the mind. And unless and until there is a transcendence of the mind, it is not possible for us to understand many, many things. Because mind cannot give us the understanding of everything, that which lies beyond the scope of the mind. In other words, the Bhagavad Gita speaks not merely of the mind, but of going beyond the mind. And going beyond the mind demands the technique of experiencing the total silence of the mind. But Arjuna says, as was said earlier, when the certain Bhagavad Gita recitations were given to us, Arjuna says, Lord, your philosophy may be sublime, but your philosophy is of no use to me. And Shri Krishna says, why? Why is my philosophy no use to you? Because Arjuna says, I cannot control my mind. I cannot hold my mind. Unless you tell me how to hold the mind, so that the mind does not slip away. I hold the mind. Unless you tell me how to hold the mind, whatever you are telling me, your message may be beautiful, but it has no relevance so far as I am concerned. It is there that the Bhagavad Gita gives the simplest formula. You cannot find a simpler formula than the one that you find in the Bhagavad Gita. You find a mention of this formula in one of the Upanishads, but the Bhagavad Gita gives us very, very simply. The Bhagavad Gita says, watch your mind in action. You cannot watch mind by closing the doors and the windows, closing your eyes and say, now I'm going to watch the mind. You cannot watch the mind in there. The mind has to be watched in action, in the midst of action, in the midst of activity, in the midst of what the mind is doing. See what the mind is doing. And this seeing is a very, very important thing. This is what we are going to discuss. Because observe the mind. But what does the observation of the mind mean? Can we observe the mind? Can the mind observe itself? This whole subject of observation is a part of meditation. We will not go into the whole of meditation, but we will certainly examine what is this technique of observation. Because the Bhagavad Gita says, if you can do this, if you can observe your mind in action, what is it that the mind is doing? If you can see that, if you can observe that, but observe how? Observe without acceptance or without rejection. The Bhagavad Gita says that when you observe without attachment and without rejection, then your mind is quiet. Your mind is not going to judge, I shall accept this and I shall reject this. No acceptance, no rejection. If with that attitude, if with that presence, you are able to look at the mind, how it functions, then the Bhagavad Gita says, in that very observation, observation without acceptance or rejection, it is in that very observation you will find that you have found the skill by which you can control the mind, you can hold the mind, that the mind does not run away. These are some of the things which we find in the Bhagavad Gita, very beautifully stated. And therefore, as I said, the Bhagavad Gita is not a book just to be read. The Bhagavad Gita is a book which has to be experienced. I have been a student of Bhagavad Gita. I have also committed the error of writing a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. But if I read that commentary which I have written today, I feel dissatisfied. I must write another commentary and another commentary. Because there is so much that one discovers in the Bhagavad Gita that one is never tired of speaking about the message of the Gita or about writing commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita. Such is the vastness. In fact, the Bhagavad Gita is a book where little children can play about in the shallows. There are also shallows in the Bhagavad Gita where little children can play about. But there are depths into which even the experts dare not go. There are such depths, enormous depths, that the experts themselves are afraid of going into the depths. And yet there are shallows where little children can play. This is the magnificent beauty so far as the Bhagavad Gita is concerned. I have just placed before you what it is. It is the path of going from mind to supermind, where the realm of the mind is left behind. Mind realizing that it cannot go further. The mind that is aware of its own limitations, and having become aware of its limitations, there is the jump of consciousness, and the Bhagavad Gita deals with this jump of consciousness. This is all that I can say so far as this introductory talk is concerned. We will have to come again and again to the Bhagavad Gita, certain aspects of the Bhagavad Gita, because the Bhagavad Gita is a whole book. It is a book which is full of integration. It is a book which throws light on many, many aspects which otherwise we don't understand. It is a book which leads us from mind to supermind. It leads us from the realm of the mind where we ordinarily move about, from the realm of the mind to that realm which is beyond the province of the mind, beyond the scope of the mind. It is this that is covered so far as the Bhagavad Gita is concerned. It deals with the growth of consciousness. What is the consciousness of the mind? And it deals very, very effectively with the consciousness of the mind. It shows us how this consciousness of the mind is limited, and it shows us the way as to how to transcend the limitations of the mind. As I said earlier, he who knows not merely the capacities and the possibilities of the mind, but he who also knows the limitations of the mind. Having known the possibilities, he is aware of the limitations of the mind. He has transcended the frontiers of the mind. He has gone over to that realm which is the realm of buddhi, the realm of intelligence. Such a man does not behave, act in terms of the intellect, but he is beginning to behave and act in terms of intelligence. From intellect to intelligence, that is the way that Bhagavad Gita shows. This is the growth of consciousness that is depicted in this very absorbing book, the Bhagavad Gita, which belongs to no religion. It belongs to all. It is a book of entire humanity, because here in this book, things are treated in a completely secular manner. So that your religion may be whatever it is, your commitments may be whatever it is, but here is the book that gives us enlightenment along many, many problems of life. It leads us from mind to the supermind. it leads us from the realm of the mind to the realm of intelligence. Thank you very much.